Good evening. I'm Roger Pasquier. I chair the book jury here, and I'm very happy to welcome all of you. There are some empty seats, and if those of you who are standing outside can come in and find these seats. If you're next to an empty seat, why don't you raise your hand and help the people in the back to get to those seats. So I'd like to welcome all of you here this evening. Thank you for coming. I want to start by thanking my fellow jurors, whose names you'll find in the program, for another year of a very stimulating series of discussions, which I always find much more interesting than I imagine any book club can be. I also want to thank two trustees who've been very involved in our book awards, Ellen Eisman, who supports the book awards, and Jenny Lawrence, who is going to speak a little bit later, who has supported and started the Hornblower Prize, which is for a first book, a first-time book author who was also writing about New York. And I thought that our winners and perhaps everybody else would be interested to know what the process is. How did we get this down to the three winners of this year? This year, we considered about 150 books that were published in 2011 about New York. Every year, there is somewhere between 150 and 200 that are published about topics large and small, familiar and new. And we always look for books that will give insight into an aspect of New York life, past or present, and that will be enjoyed by library members. We are not obliged to give books on any fixed topics, so we never run the risk of the embarrassment of the Pulitzer judges who couldn't find a novel that they wanted to award this year. You may have noticed that last week the mayor announced that the city is now going to give prizes for authors of books about New York. They're going to give prizes that honor authors living and dead for their total work, not for any particular book. And I was interested to see in the first list of authors living and dead how many of them had a close association with this library. And in due course, we hope that some of the authors whom we have given prizes to will be on the city's list as well. So the jury helps us separate the books that are authoritative and original from those that are derivative and error-filled. And every book every book that comes to us, we start by having at least one juror read, and if there's a positive vote on that, we have more jurors read, so that by the time we get to the semifinals, the most promising books, we seek to have every juror read each of those books, and then we come to our decisions by consensus. The list of jury members which you have includes all of us who are active in the New York literary world as either authors, editors, journalists, or publishers, and perhaps you have read some books by some of us. This year's winners testify to the diversity and specialization of the books that we review and have found outstanding. And this year, we're going to have three of our jurors introduce each of those books because we have jurors who are specialists in the topics that the award winners have written. And has Mr. Cole arrived? Oh, good. So we're going to start with your book, and Meg Wolitzer, a novelist on our committee, is going to introduce him. I will do all the introductions for the three committee speakers, and then they will take over, and then we can have questions for the authors at the end of the third presentation. And Jenny Lawrence, who is providing the Hornblower Award, will speak also on that. So Meg Wolitzer, the first of our committee members who's going to speak, is the author of nine novels, most recently The Uncoupling. She's taught creative writing at the University of Iowa's Writers' Workshop, at Skidmore, and at Columbia. And next year, she'll be a guest artist at Princeton's Atelier program. Jules Cohn, who is going to introduce Brownstone Brooklyn, is a I'm sorry, got that confused, is going to introduce Black Gotham, is a professor emeritus of political science at CUNY. He's been a member of the Joint Center for Urban Studies at Harvard-MIT, and he's the author of The Conscience of Corporations and numerous articles in scholarly and popular journals and magazines. And Andrew Dolkart, who may or may not get here because of a torn meniscus, is indeed going to introduce Brownstone Brooklyn. If he gets here, if he doesn't, I will do that. But just to let you know who he is, should he limp in here, he is the director of the Historic Preservation Program at Columbia and the James Marston Fitch Professor of Historic Preservation at Columbia School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation. He is a historian on the architecture and development of New York City and has written several books, and we have twice given awards to his books, to Biography of a Tenement House in New York City and Row House Reborn. So after he received two awards, then we put him on our jury. So for you first-time winners, there's a larger hope for you as well. So I will turn this over to Meg, who will do the first of the introductions of our awardees. Thank you.
One quality that distinguishes New York from other cities is its walkability, or more than that, its siren call invitation to be walked in, its irresistibility for the potential walker. It's interesting, then, to think how few novels have spent a lot of time capturing this particular quality. More frequently, it's been the extended territory of journalism or meditations. There's a sense of New York City in some novels as a place made up of buildings with rooms in which people talk and outdoor spaces in which people sometimes also talk. But in his remarkable novel, Open City, Teju Cole takes his narrator, Julius, a young Nigerian-German psychiatrist, on a peripatetic journey around an intricate, multiracial, eclectic New York 5 years after September 11th. Cole gives him an elliptical quality that partly unwinds, as the story does, and he also gives him movement and interactions with other city people. The whole effect is that of a mesmerizing and subtle living mural. Reading fiction and walking have a lot in common, I think. Both of them require, in a sense, a kind of throwback mentality. You know, in both cases, that you could get somewhere quicker. But when you walk, it's as if public transportation just doesn't exist. And when you read a serious, thoughtful novel, it's as if the world, with all its distractions, doesn't exist. Both acts require patience and intimacy, and the rewards can be many, as you can see in the following passage from Open City. That afternoon, during which I flitted in and out of myself, when time became elastic and voices cut out of the past into the present, the heart of the city was gripped by what seemed to be a commotion from an earlier time. I feared being caught up in what, it seemed to me, were draft riots. The people I saw were all men hurrying along under leafless trees, sidestepping the fallen police barrier near me and others farther away. There was some kind of scuffle some 200 yards down the street, again strangely noiseless, and a huddled knot of men opened up to reveal two brawlers being separated and pulled away from their fight. What I saw next gave me a fright. In the farther distance, beyond the listless crowd, the body of a lynched man dangling from a tree. The figure was slender, dressed from head to toe in black, reflecting no light. It soon resolved itself, however, into a less ominous thing, dark canvas sheeting on a construction scaffold twirling in the wind. Teju Cole, who lives in Brooklyn, was born in 1975 in the U.S. and raised in Nigeria. He's the author of two books, a novella called Every Day is for the Thief, and this novel, Open City, which won the Penn Hemingway Award, the Rosenthal Award of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and was shortlisted for a National Book Critics Circle Award. His work has appeared in the New York Times, The New Yorker, and Tin House, among others. He's a writer and art historian and a street photographer and distinguished writer in residence at Bard College. I should mention that a part of this novel includes a detailed walk around Brussels, and I hope that Brussels is sensible enough to give him a prize as well. But in the meantime, we are very happy to present him with this award tonight.
Thank you very much. I, as you all were informed, I was a little bit late getting here because I was having a New York experience of missing three trains in a row. But I'm glad I made it on time. I would just like to read a little section of the book, even though Meg already shared some of it with you, but to give you a better sense of what this little book is about. I'm more surprised than anybody else could possibly be that the Open City got the attention that it did, because I wrote a novel without a plot, and it's digressive and it's introspective, but somehow it found its way to its readers, and I'm immensely grateful for that. I'll just read the first half page of the part one of the book, and then the first half page of part two of the book. This is how the book begins. And so when I began to go on evening walks last fall, I found Morningside Heights an easy place from which to set out into the city. The path that drops down from the Cathedral of St. John the Divine and crosses Morningside Park is only 15 minutes from Central Park. In the other direction, going west, it is some 10 minutes to Sakura Park, and walking northward from there brings you toward Harlem along the Hudson, though traffic makes the river on the other side of the trees inaudible. These walks, a counterpoint to my busy days at the hospital, steadily lengthened, taking me farther and farther afield each time, so that I found myself at quite a distance from home late at night and was compelled to return home by subway. In this way, at the beginning of the final year of my psychiatry fellowship, New York City worked itself into my life at walking pace. And most of the book is set in New York, and the narrator's named Julius is a young psychiatrist. In the middle of the book, he goes to Brussels, which I chose as a kind of eccentric double for this city, another city with too many unexamined layers. The second part begins with him returning from Brussels. These thoughts had returned even before I was properly back in the city. The pilot's voice crackling through the system, "We're now making our final approach for landing," added to the anxiety of return, because those ordinary and by now banal words seemed to carry some ghostly portent. My thoughts quickly became entangled with one another, so that in addition to the usual morbid thoughts one normally has on a plane, I was saddled with strange mental transpositions, that the plane was a coffin, that the city below was a vast graveyard with white marble and stone blocks of various heights and sizes. But as we broke through the last layer of clouds and the city in its true form suddenly appeared 1,000 feet below us, the impression I had was not at all morbid. What I experienced was the unsettling feeling that I had had precisely this view of the city before, accompanied by the equally strong feeling that it had not been from the point of view of a plane. Then it came to me. I was remembering something I had seen about a year earlier, the sprawling scale model of the city that was kept at the Queen's Museum of Art. The model had been built for the World's Fair in 1964 at great cost, and afterward had been periodically updated to keep up with the changing topography and built environment of the city. It showed in impressive detail, with almost 1 million tiny buildings and with bridges, parks, rivers, and architectural landmarks, the true form of the city. The attention to detail was so meticulous that one could not help but think of Borges's cartographers, who, obsessed with accuracy, had made a map so large and so finely detailed that it matched the empire's scale on a ratio of 1 to 1. A map in which each thing coincided with its spot on the map. The map proved so unwieldy that it was eventually folded up and left to rot in the desert. Our view from the plane as we banked over Queens itself brought all of that back to mind, and in this case, it was the real city that seemed to be matching, point for point, my memory of the model, which I had stared at for a long time from a ramp in the museum. Even the raking evening light falling across the city evoked the spotlighting used at the museum. On the day I had seen the panorama, I had been impressed by the many fine details it presented, the rivulets of roads snaking across the velvety Central Park, the boomerang of the Bronx curving up to the north, the elegant beige spire of the Empire State Building, the white tablets of the Brooklyn Piers, and the pair of gray blocks on the southern tip of Manhattan, each about a foot high, representing the persistence in the model of the World Trade Center towers, which in reality had already been destroyed. And I'll stop there. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks very much to the Society for recognizing this book. It's a marvelous feeling to be read. I recommend it. To have people you've never met and whom you do not know spend time with your work is a perpetually astonishing honor, and I'm greatly honored by this award. And I'm happy to win, but I'm happy simply to have been considered, because so very many great books are made each year that winning anything at all feels like a crapshoot. But being read does feel in part like a tribute to myself and to all the people who worked on the book with me. So my very sincere thanks. Thank you very much.
I really like this book. Black Gotham is the book. It's an astounding and path-breaking book. I've written a piece about it, and one reason that I'm not used to sort of reading my notes, but this time I'm going to do it, and I think the reason for that is that I was really very excited about this book and about the work of Carla Peterson, Professor Peterson, the author of the book. So excited, and so many different thoughts and feelings about it, that I thought I'd better get this organized and down on paper. So that's what I've tried to do. Black Gotham is an astounding, path-breaking book. It's about black New Yorkers in the 19th century, educated, cultured blacks, elite families who lived and worked in downtown Manhattan, later in Brooklyn, in racially mixed neighborhoods. It's not the Harlem model. So right away, it's a surprise to many people, the material in this book. It's also about the substantial institutions they founded, newspapers, churches, schools, exclusive clubs, and societies. We're a society library. We're called the Society Library. And right away in reading this book, I began to think institutionally. I have a lot of thoughts about this place and its history. And I saw in Carla Peterson's book ideas of my own here and there. These people, this black elite in New York, participated as much as possible in those times, as much as they could, of course, in the life of the city as leaders, organizers, cultural figures. And this black elite is part of Professor Peterson's family history. And it was her quest for that history that makes Black Gotham memorable. The facts were largely unknown to her when she started because not much had been passed on to her by her parents. The past was either forgotten or intentionally suppressed. Black Gotham is about an intrepid author's determination to find, in spatial, social, cultural, and historical terms, where she came from, to find what she calls home. Her quest begins in a library and concludes with a visit to a cemetery in Brooklyn. She lets us in on how she pored over scrapbooks stored in institutional archives, clippings, letters, photos, ticket stubs, to find the story of her family and connect herself to what turned out to be a remarkable legacy, and at the same time to tell a new version of Black American and New York history. She's added a jewel of a book to the catalog of writings about our city's cultural, political, and social life in the 19th century. In an autobiographical essay published elsewhere, I thought, I got to read more about this woman. So I looked her up and found this and that and the other thing. And in this essay elsewhere, she described her work as self-inclusive scholarship. And that's the brilliance of the book. It is scholarship. It is about New York. It is history. But it's also about Carla Peterson and her family and her finding her place in all this. But this book is about even more. It's about the fragility of social as well as family memory and the importance of preserving it. It's about legacy. The New York Society Library is fond, sometimes I think even vain, of its own legacy. So here's the reason why I now and then thought of the centuries-old institution and our tenacious hold on whatever evidence we have of our own past, stored in acid-free boxes upstairs in the room we here in the library call Stack 8. One box in that temperature-controlled room is labeled ephemera, not a Dewey Decimal classification, but a category for which I have new regard after seeing what Carla Peterson makes out of the bits and pieces of the past. In Black Gotham, Professor Peterson has transgressed traditional academic boundaries. She's an academic for sure, but after studying some of her other writings, I realize she can't be cubbyholed. She teaches English, but she's also written about history, feminism, 19th century French and English novels. And an earlier book of hers, I think it's the first, is called The Determined Reader. And over the past several weeks, I have been her determined reader, challenged, impressed, and amused by her dexterity with the latest methodologies of structuralism, post-structuralism, deconstruction, critical theory, gender studies. Don't get nervous, it's not in this book. She can write from the heart, but she can also handle the jargon. Finally, there's a sadness and a triumph in this book, for Black Gotham is about even more than I've been able to convey. It's about the trauma of loss and the melancholy that comes from mourning that's never completed. Professor Peterson confronts the painful effects of loss on individual lives, but also ponders its effects on the lives of families and communities, and maybe institutions too. In Black Gotham, she repairs ruptures in our civic history and restores memory not only for herself, but she enhances and fills out the record for us, for New Yorkers. She reflects on what she calls the legacy of silence she had been living with when she began her project. The absence of memory has weighed heavily on me, she writes, and her book is an exciting and moving effort to lift that weight. Carla Peterson.
Good evening, everybody. So I just met Jules tonight, but he's left me speechless. He said everything that I wanted to say, so I could just say thank you and sit down. Why'd you do that? Anyway, good evening to everybody, and it's a real honor for me to be here and to have been the recipient of the New York Society Library Prize in History. The best prizes are the surprises, the ones that surprise. And this was certainly a surprise to me to get a prize and then also to have it be in history because, as Jules said, I'm not a historian, but I'm a trained literary critic. So thank you to the library and thank you to the jury as well. So I will indeed say a few words about my book. I'm going to read a tiny little bit from the prologue, two short paragraphs, and then I will talk a little bit about what, well, I'm a professor, so I've divided into why I wrote the book, what's in the book, and what's the takeaway of the book, okay? Yeah. So just to start off, two quotes. One is, the first one is my own prose from the prologue, and the second one is a quote from Toni Morrison's Beloved, and that is the epigraph of the prologue. So the first one, we still hold certain truths about African Americans to be self-evident, that the phrase 19th century black Americans refers to enslaved people, that New York State before the Civil War denotes a place of freedom, that blacks in New York City designates Harlem, that the black community posits a classless and culturally unified society, that a black elite did not exist until well into the 20th century. The lives of my New York forebears belie such assumptions. They were born free at a time when slavery was still legal in New York State. They lived in racially mixed neighborhoods, first in Lower Manhattan, and then after the Civil War in Brooklyn, at a time when Harlem was a mere village. They were part of New York's small but significant black community, and specifically its elite class. So as I started the book and started thinking about Black New York in the 19th century, these were the challenges or the assumptions that I faced and was determined to overcome in my work. And then I reread Toni Morrison's Beloved and came across this quote. Denver was seeing it now and feeling it through Beloved. And the more fine points she made, the more details she provided, the more Beloved liked it. So she anticipated the questions by giving blood to the scraps her mother and grandmother told her, and a heartbeat. Denver spoke, Beloved listened, and the two did the best they could to create what really happened, how it really was, something only Setha knew, because she alone had the mind for it and the time afterward to shape it. And that quote spoke to me so powerfully because it felt that that was exactly what I wanted to do with my book, with Black Gotham, that I wanted to take memories of forebears, memories that weren't mine, memories, in fact, of people that I didn't know, and put blood and a heartbeat on them. And when I read that the New York Society Library gave prizes to books that evoke the spirit or enhance appreciation of New York City, I thought, well, maybe I actually nailed it. And I was able to do that, to give blood and a heartbeat to my ancestors and thereby to 19th century Black New York. So the reason why I decided to do this book of 19th century Black New York through my family was, one, obviously personal. I wanted to know more about my family. I knew very little. I thought it would be really exciting to find out things about them. But it also, and Jules spoke to this a little bit, really brings up in a very powerful way issues of memory and forgetting that we experience as individuals, that we experience as families or as societies. So again, invoking Toni Morrison, what is it that we choose to pass down? What are the stories we choose to pass on? What are those we don't? What do we want to remember? What do we want to forget? And in the case of my family, for reasons that I'm really not sure of, I speculate in the book, there were stories that they did not pass down to me. And so that was a very powerful way of getting at this issue that affects us all, whether we're African Americans, Jews, Irish, or whoever, as members of a social group. I also thought that it was important to maybe write a history of African Americans, and particularly in the 19th century, through the lens of family, because this was a period when society, the nation at large, simply did not believe that African Americans were capable of having families, that we knew nothing about the ties that bind, about nurture, about intimacy. And so, of course, under slavery, it was so easy to disrupt families, sell children off from mothers and fathers, divide spouses, and so forth and so on. So simply the idea of being able to write a history that invoked family and family life in as intimate way as I could was really very important to me. And also that so many of us, African Americans and others as well, feel that our family has been lost to us, what Jules was talking about, the trauma of loss. And so many of us assume that we cannot recover it. And so determined that I was, I thought, well, maybe I can recover something. So my book unfolds on two levels. I first of all had to confront the fact that I knew very little about my family, that my family hadn't passed down stories, so that I had to go to the archives and try and recover material. So that indeed the first level of my book is my hunt in the archives, which extends to city streets. There's nothing like prowling on the streets of New York and going to corners or spots that are identified in 19th century documents and using that as an archive as well. And the second then is the history of my family, what I found and how I put it together. And the history is both chronological. It focuses on my great-great-grandfather and his son-in-law, my great-grandfather, because those were the two people who were the most accessible in the archives. But it's also what a friend of mine has liked to call a social geography, in the sense that it deals so much with the city of Gotham. The fact that where you lived in the 19th century mattered so much that blacks were not segregated in a neighborhood like Harlem, but lived all over. And indeed, that's why I called the book Black Gotham as opposed to My Family and Their Friends or something like that. Okay, so now a little bit about the outcome. On a personal level, it's been just an amazing, I hate that word journey, it's so overused, but journey for me, getting to know my 19th century ancestors, sometimes in a very intimate way, basically knowing that my great-grandfather's pharmacy, drugstore, was a safe haven for blacks during the draft riots when he lived in the middle of an Irish neighborhood, knowing that my my great-great-grandfather's son from a second marriage was shot to death while a student at Oberlin, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, getting to know these facts was really wonderful. One of the things, though, that I found the most touching to me and really important was that I discovered, not in my direct family, but in my collateral family, my great-great-grand aunt and uncle in that line of the family, that there'd been a real desire to record this history and to pass it on. So my desire to write this book actually goes back to my great-great-grand-uncle, Albro Lyons, who wrote at one point that he always wanted to write the history of the men of his generation, and that he would call it The Gentleman in Black. And he said, I never got farther than the title, which is The Gentleman in Black. So then he said to his daughter, Maricha Lyons, that he wanted her to write the story for him. And she wrote an 85-page draft, which is now in the Schomburg Center, where I found it and poured through it and found a lot of information. And she called it Memories of Yesterdays, all of which I saw and part of which I was, an autobiography. But it's a draft, and it was never published. So that, to me, was my legacy or my inheritance and what I felt that I had to do. Of course, then there is my connection to the city. As I said, now I feel very rooted from having grown up abroad. I spent my formative years out of this country in Beirut, Lebanon, and Geneva, Switzerland, where my father worked in international public health. And I never felt rooted, and indeed I found home when I came to New York. And man, do I feel like a Gothamite. I really do. And just to close, I really took to heart what was said before about having readers. So I've discovered readers, and I've made friends. And so I want to, I've given a lot of book talks, and so people come up to me after and talk to me, and they've become my friends. Some of them almost my stalkers. So he knows who I'm going to call out. There's Stanton Biddle over there. There's Michael Adams. There's Prithi. There's Amelia. All of these people who've come to talk after talk that I've given. How many? Four or five? I don't know. And it's just been wonderful knowing how much they care about the book. And the last thing that I'm doing, which is, I hope, making friends, although not on Facebook, is I've set about creating a digital archive as a way of reaching even more people. So the launch is planned for May 20th, although who knows. And the archive is Black Gotham Archive. So if you're interested in finding out more about my ancestors, you can log on to that after May 20th. But that, to me, is a way as was said before, of even having more readers, accumulating more readers, and enjoying the interaction, the interplay that comes with my readers. And I think some of them are actually going to become writers through the digital archive. That's my hope, to turn my readers into writers. So once again, thanks so, so much for the award. Truly, truly honored. Thank you.
I'm Jenny Lawrence, and it's a pleasure tonight to give the first ever Hornblower Award to Suleiman Osman for the invention of Brownstone Brooklyn, Gentrification and the Search for Authenticity in Postwar New York, published by Oxford University Press in 2011. The $5,000 Hornblower Award is for a first published book about New York. My father, George Marshall Hornblower, in his bequest to the library, wanted to promote the interests of its member writers, to provide a place and atmosphere that would foster this community. To that end, funds from the bequest were used to renovate the library's fifth floor in 2010, creating a general writing room that accommodates 30 people, and in addition, 6 individual writing rooms. In the winter of 2009, Carolyn Waters, writer services librarian and now assistant head librarian, initiated the Writing Life series, daytime talks of topical interest to writers by writers. The series has expanded. Writing groups in fiction, memoir, nonfiction, and poetry have been particularly popular. And now the Hornblower Award adds yet another dimension to the library in honoring an emerging writer. The library has attracted many writers over its 258 years, from Herman Melville, George Templeton Strong, and Lewis Mumford, to Wendy Wasserstein, Tom Wolfe, and Alfred Kazin. The city has often been a major player in their books. The jury picked this work from more than 30 entries submitted in the category of first published books about New York. Suleiman portrays gentrification, brownstoning, neighborhood revitalization, call it what you will, the influx of white-collar professionals into this borough of homes we know as Brooklyn during the 1960s and 70s. He informs this portrait with vivid forays into Brooklyn's beginnings. I learned, for example, that brownstone is soft Triassic sandstone cut from a belt of local quarries that run from Portland, Connecticut to Paterson, New Jersey, that it's pink when first cut, but over time turns chocolate brown. Or about Brooklyn's 10-mile waterfront from Red Hook to Williamsburg. I was completely unaware that the Port of Brooklyn operated 200 piers, handled 45% of the city's waterfront commerce. The borough is a veritable palimpsest of factories, waterfront piers, and Victorian townhouses to which the brownstoners and their allies applied a do-it-yourself bootstrap neighborhood rehabilitation. Suleiman's roots are in Brooklyn. He moved with his parents to Park Slope when he was 8. He went to the UN school, his father worked for the UN, and then to Stuyvesant. In 1995, he graduated from Yale in history and then taught junior high school social studies at Grace Church School in Manhattan for 3 years before starting a PhD in American Studies at Harvard. His dissertation was the basis of Brownstone Brooklyn. Suleiman has been an assistant professor of American Studies at George Washington University since 2006 with a special focus on urban history. He's will have a sabbatical year to develop a new book project, which will be about neighborhood movements in the 1970s in America, Canada, and Europe, applying his Brownstone Brooklyn insights to other cities. He will be based in Berlin for his sabbatical year, but hopes to spend some time when he is in New York at the library. Please join me in congratulating Suleiman as the first recipient of the Hornblower Award.
Few more words, although there's not much more that I need to say. But among the things that we particularly enjoyed about this book was the rich scope of the history that was examined, including the entire literary history of Brooklyn. And in this era when everybody seems to be searching for authenticity, Professor Osman found how little there really is in Brooklyn in these neighborhoods and how much was really an invention of the people who were moving in and trying to create both a new identity for themselves through a kind of validation of a creation of an older identity that these parts of Brooklyn really didn't have, or at least not to the extent that they claimed, either architecturally, historically, or in terms of the people who used to live in those neighborhoods. So we found that the book has a lot of humor as well as many other great qualities that made it a pleasure to read and gave us all fresh eyes as we look at these new hot parts of Brooklyn that make us who live in Manhattan feel inadequate today, and also as we watch the pace of gentrification, or whatever else you may want to call it, move through other neighborhoods beyond the ones that he addresses that reach their present aura after decades of work in the mid-20th century. So I will let you take it over, tell us more.
Thank you. Okay.
One more point just about the Hornblower Awards, which I forgot to mention, is that when Jenny first offered us this, my concern, and perhaps that of other members of the jury, is would there be many books by first-time authors about New York? And we were astounded to find, as Jenny mentioned, that there were at least 30 this year. We also thought, are we going to have to judge them on a different level because they're first-time authors? And we found not at all, that we could judge them with the same rigor as every other book, and we were, in fact, completely blind on whether they were first-time authors or long-time authors until we got to the final round and saw that, indeed, some of the ones that we looked at were by first-time authors. So the Hornblower Award has enabled us to cite authors who are making very promising starts in their first books, but we are not treating them with any less rigor as we treat every other author who has been writing about New York or other topics for a long time.
Thank you. Thank you very much to the library for this award, and thank you very much to the Hornblower family. It's very quite an honor and very flattering to receive an award from such an esteemed institution. I think people who have written a first book know the periods of doubt. I've heard this happens, this never goes away, but you know, the sense of doubt about what you're writing, does this work, and to have it win an award is an incredible accomplishment, and incredibly flattering. I also want to thank, I have my parents and my sister in the audience and how supportive they've been, and so I just want to say how proud I am of them that they're here, and how nice it is to receive an award with them here. I'm also flattered to share the state, to follow two such accomplished authors who have explored New York with such nuance and really exploring, fascinating to hear the perspectives of a New York from the exploration of the city from bird's eye view versus the peripatetic flaneur wandering through the streets, or the city as palimpsest of memory that you're kind of delayering, both personal and history, and it's wonderful to be able to follow them. And also, lastly, the book itself explores about brownstones as repositories of symbolism, how people read brownstones in multiple ways, how they themselves are repositories of memory. And to receive an award in a building that is such a repository of memory, and both in terms of the books, but also in terms of its history, is also quite fitting, and it's very nice to be in such a wonderful institution. You know, what's been amazing to me about when publishing the first book is it's a book ostensibly about the 50s, 60s, and 70s, about a few neighborhoods in Brooklyn. Yet it really, you know, when you give a book talk or when you talk to people, especially if they're Brooklynites in the audience or new Brooklynites, old Brooklynites, the issue sparks a lot of feelings, even though the book is about the 60s and 70s. And I think part of the reason, as was mentioned by the two speakers before, is that Brownstone Brooklyn, which is a title from the early 70s for a group of enclaves, Brooklyn Heights, Cobble Hill, coined in 1958, in the 60s, Borum Hill, Carroll Gardens was coined in the 60s, but a series of these new enclaves, and by the 70s is referred to as Brownstone Brooklyn, is a hotly contested landscape. It's a landscape that people love passionately, or they love to hate, and the people who hate it secretly love it, and the people who love it secretly hate it. It's celebrated and parodied for many of the same characteristics that it has. There is some sense that it's both a bastion of progressive politics, really emerging from the neighborhood movements of the 60s and 70s. It's also decried for being elitist. It's some ways seen as the sign of authentic city living, really the embodiment of what Jane Jacobs was describing in the 60s, that this is a successful culmination of the anti-Moses movement, that this is an authentic place, yet it's also parodied as being fake. It's a site of community power, of neighborhood engagement, of a type of local politics or it's also decried as the NIMBY neighborhood where you can't even build bike lanes, right? These two sort of sense of opposites, a site which is a sense of place, really as opposed to the modernist stuff built in the 50s and 60s, that this is an exploration of local place, or is it a site where people are being displaced? And what was interesting to write a book about the 60s was to see about how a lot of the debates about Brownstone Brooklyn in 2012 were taking place in the 50s and 60s, or even have their roots in the 50s and 60s. But it's not just a sense of what's interesting is that, wow, this all has its roots early on. But what part of the thing that the books argues is that the emergence of the brownstoning movement was precisely rooted in the movements of the 1960s of a variety of ways and all its contradictions. And this is precisely why, in some ways, it inspires such detractors and defenders in 2012 in a way that, let's say, Scarsdale doesn't, right? So like Scarsdale, there's no debate, right? But Park Slope is a debate. Is it a success or a failure? And precisely it's because of a sort of ideal that was people were thinking about in the 60s and the sense that has that ideal gone awry? Did it ever exist? Did it always have internal contradictions? I mean, all the debates that you hear about, let's say, Park Slope in 2012, like let's say the size of baby carriages or people using nannies in the food co-op or, you know, these sort of whether to have bike lanes or not, are all kind of contested in some ways because they are an outgrowth of the baby boomers in the 1960s. So it becomes a way to discuss not just urbanism and this particular neighborhood, but also have what has been this legacy or success of the baby boomers moving to the cities in the 60s. I mean, the only reason that the debates about the food co-op is really a debate about the legacy of the counterculture and this emergence of this commune, the mongoose group, I think, I can't remember the name that they started it, but of all those communes of the early 1970s, what of them? Have they become totally bourgeois, or is, you know, what's the, you know. The size of the baby carriages is, in fact, really about a neighborhood that was the site of second wave feminism and sort of debates about family, and there's a sort of a sense of debates about this is why it's, debated. And even the bike lanes, right, which is fascinating, should there be bike lanes or not, is really almost interesting to see how both groups are both the proponents of bike lanes and the critics of bike lanes see themselves as both embodying the legacy of Jane Jacobs, right? In the sense of both legacies of the anti-Moses movement of the 60s. That the pro-bike lanes see the bike lanes as sort of an emergence of a new type of planning, that this is a sort of an embrace of walkability, embrace of bike lanes, that this is in fact the successful culmination of what the book describes. The detractors from the bike lanes see this also as defending local neighborhoods from the encroachment of, once again, the master planners, right? So it's interesting to see how all of these, even the word yuppie, of course, which is from the early 1980s, is contentious only in as much as that it's a play on the word hippie, and that's a sort of, what is the legacy of the late 1960s? So whether celebrated as an example of urban revitalization run amok, or the emergence of a type of exciting new urbanism, a rediscovery of the center city, a type of progressive living, the book tries to explore this in all its nuances. And basically, to keep this relatively short, is like I was going to give sort of the pitch of what the book is about, right? It's like, I do describe gentrification as, I talk in detail about it, you know, the economics reasons, housing prices, growth, demographic shifts. But what I think is kind of interesting, too, is that this shift to the center city was linked to the emergence of a new middle class, particularly linked to the baby boom, and the search, part of the 60s search for authenticity. And the reimagining of older industrial districts in the center city as a site of authenticity, particularly in contrast to the suburbs of the 1950s, and all the complexity and both progressive and conflicted and perhaps even contradictory at times that search for authenticity was. And at the core of the search for the authenticity was the brownstone. And in some ways, the book is an exploration of the brownstone as changing symbol, the brownstone as this repository for symbolic value, how this seemingly mass-produced townhouse for the 19th century, as it becomes weathered with age, as it develops all its different characteristics, becomes seen by various groups as sites of authenticity, self-discovery, ethnic authenticity, historic authenticity. So that's the book. Thank you again for having me here. Thank you for this award. I'm enormously flattered, and I look forward to talking more. Okay, thanks.
We're going to have a short time when you can actually speak to the writers at a microphone so that we can all hear the questions and answers. So if the three could come to the front, that would be great. Thank you all for your patience. While they're getting set up, I just wanted to thank once again Ellen Eisman, who is here in the third row. Ellen, please wave. Ellen is the underwriter for this year's New York City Book Awards. Thank you so much, Ellen. And this has been a marvelous evening. I had a member say to me earlier, has it always been crowded like this? And I said, well, the jurors will tell you they remember years ago when we struggled with getting people to come, but that's not been the case for quite a while. We've had good numbers, and we're so glad that you were all able to be with us this evening. So let's take 5 to 10 minutes. If any of you do need to leave, feel free to get up and go, but why don't we have a short question and answer period, so if you could address the winners, please go ahead.
My name is Stanton Gable, I'm a librarian. I used to work at Schomburg. In your book talks and your presentations of Black Gotham, how much new information has emerged about the same period?
Oh, Stanton, what a setup. You gave the information to me. The question was, what new information have I come across in giving my book talks about Black Gotham? I didn't say very much about the book, the people in the book itself, or what it's about. So basically, it's about my great-great-grandfather and my great-grandfather as members of this small elite, fairly tiny elite in New York City. The fact that they live downtown, cheek by jowl with whites of all classes and ethnicities and backgrounds, and their struggles to succeed. They happened to be pharmacists, but there were doctors, there were ministers, there were teachers, they had community organizations. But every time they tried, they were climbing the mountain towards success, they'd be slapped down by mob violence. The 1834 race riot and then later on, which took place largely around Five Points, and then later on the draft riots, which I think most of you are quite familiar with. So two new things that I found, and one given by you, Stanton. One of the things that really that I found most difficult in working on Black Gotham was that even when I came across material, the material was so often from a white perspective and with whites writing the white voice. So if you take the New York draft riots, that's what happens. You have a lot of documents that come out from the mayor's office, the governor's office, the military, the NYPD, whatever. But it's very hard to find accounts by blacks themselves. They're newspaper accounts, but I found out many of them were published for the first time in the New York Daily Tribune, and then they just got recycled from one newspaper to another, including the African-American newspaper at the time, the Weekly Anglo-African. So what Stanton did was put me onto, so I wrote about it, lamenting the lack of black voices, looking for what I could, but Stanton then found something after I published the book, which is an account by a young man by the name of Thomas Barnes, who was a child at the time in the colored orphan asylum at the time that it was attacked and burned to the ground. And that is a truly, truly vivid firsthand account. And that was pretty amazing to see that. The other, and I'll be really quick, is the dearth of material about Black women before the Civil War and how hard that was to find. And so the pitch I gave in my book and in my talks has always been school teachers, school teachers, school teachers, go to the Public School Society records and see what you can find. And in the past month, I've discovered that where they are as well, but it's going to be hard to get at, are the vigilance committees. So those are part of the Underground Railroad. They're the committees sponsored by blacks coming out of the black community, where when an escaped slave is on the Underground Railroad and stops in New York, somebody takes him in, hides him or her for a period of time, houses, clothes, gives food, et cetera, and sends them on their way. And within those homes, I've discovered it's women's work. And that has, to me, has been another big discovery.
Another question?
Well, it's like for you, ma'am, my father was born in 1917, the youngest, and I had the honor of spending a lot of time with my grandmother in the 60s and the early 70s. And rather than read books, she was like an encyclopedia, a lot of information there. So I wondered when your parents were born and if you had that experience leading back to the 1800s. And you, Mr. Park Slope, actually I was born in Park Slope, and I lived there all of my life.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to know if you looked into, I know it's 50s, 60s, and 70s, but the word is that Park Slope was a village before the village. It was always a mixed neighborhood until now that it's a ghetto, but all my friends collect the rent, so.
What was the last part that you said? It's a ghetto. Did you say it's a ghetto?
Ghetto now, because it was always a mixed neighborhood from the village before the village.
Yeah. Okay.
And now it's a ghetto.
Yeah.
But all my friends collect the rent. I mean, half the neighborhood's owned by a civil court judge, okay. And the other half's owned by Dixon, a little West Indian like that.
Yeah. Right. You know, the book goes in the beginning, because it talks about, to borrow from a lot of the imagery, that the two other books is the neighborhood is, you're part of the neighborhood is sort of palimpsest, this layer of histories. And I think, I can't tell how old you are, if you're from the 80s and 90s, it doesn't. But if you're from before that, it talks about the
I was born in 1961.
Okay, right. So yeah, it looks at the demographic shifts in the neighborhoods back to even before they laid down the street grid of brownstones, you know, and they had early squatters' villages in the late 19th century. But I think it's a good part of what was fun about the book is getting to speak to people who have lived there since the 60s and being able to sort of map out from their memories the way the neighborhood has changed over time and all the tensions that arise from that change.
So your question, part of it was when my parents were born.
Yeah, and did you, like my father was born in 1917.
Okay, so my parents were...
granddaddy at the crime of the scene, okay? Because, my father's half English, Scot, and half Cherokee. Branches.
Okay.
So my mother's from North Carolina. It's a very common Southern story. But the point is that he was born in 1917.
Okay.
And, so my grandmother was right there before the Civil War. So I wanted to know, did you have that experience in your own family?
Could you be a little bit more specific about
what... Where was your father born? Did you know your grandparents?
Oh, I see. I knew my grandmother on my mother's side. She came from Jamaica. The book is about my father's mother's family. And I did not know my grandparents. And...
they don't date back in the United States.
Yes, they do. My father's mother's family goes all the way back to 1779, Long Island, and then New York. That's what the book is about, how they are really New Yorkers from the late 18th century on.
But you didn't meet any of your family from the 1800s?
No. I'm not that old.
I know we have some other questions, so let's have some other questions down front. Mr. Larson?
Writing was vitally important to the group of Black New Yorkers that I talk about. And so there were many literary societies, unfortunately not long-lived because of resources, finances. But if you take, I think it's the Philomathian Society, for example, inviting young men to join. And the requirements to join was that you have good character and you donate one book to the library, or maybe it was more than one. So there was really this sense of the importance of literacy, and beyond mere literacy, of a book culture. And the importance of writing among African Americans, if you take the slave narratives, our best known example of Frederick Douglass, for example, published in 1845, and the degree to which that was so prized. But when the group of New Yorkers I talk about looked for literary models, and this I was really astonished to find out, and I've got to come here and do research, Washington Irving was a beloved, beloved writer. And they knew their Washington Irving, and when they were giving out book prizes at the public schools at the end of the year, it was Washington Irving that they gave out. Favorite British writers were Dickens, Frederick Douglass's paper, which was published out of Rochester, but was really a national paper. Serialized all of Bleak House over a period of 18 months. And Tennyson was another great, great favorite, yeah. So there was this great sense, not just of the importance of knowing how to read and write, but really of cultivating the art of writing.
Want me to go?
Yeah. Okay.
Interesting, by way of contrast, the incredible research and detail that went into Professor Peterson
lack of research.
Was there specific research that went into it? Because it was so grounded at that street level that we all keep coming back to.
Well, I mean, I think this is one of those things that reveals differences of audiences, because for certain other readers, this is, you know, the densest and most historically overburdened book they've ever read. In present company, it's sort of like a fly-by-night operation. I'm certainly not an expert on New York history. One of my concerns in writing the book was to develop a certain idea of realism in fiction. If you're having a character who is telling you a great deal about a great deal, as a fictional character, if the goal is some kind of stream of consciousness, you want to sort of keep that on some sort of level of plausibility. Not absolute plausibility, not fidelity to how much a person could actually know, but somewhere in the ballpark. So a lot of what was being discussed in the book, I tried to resist looking it up until after I had written it. So I looked things up to cross-check, but I wanted it to be more like the flow of, you know, digression and sensibility and the sorts of things that might pass through a person's mind if they are paying attention to the texture of the city. So the book is taken up very much with the idea that the book is set in 2006. The city we live in was built by others who are not here. If you raise your eyes beyond ground level, suddenly you're in the 19th century. You know, it's an old city, and we are basically the latter day arrivals in somebody else's metropolis. And I just wanted to evoke that sense of the spectral and trembling past that is present.
I think we have time for one more question.
Well, I can assure you it's not a memoir. though it is a novel that is, it covers a year in the life of Julius, 2006 to 2007. And it tries to give a memoir-like account of that year in his life. I'll tell you what my definition of a novel is. A novel is any long prose work that has elements of fantasy. Plot has nothing to do with it. Characters, the clunky machinery of, you know, whodunit is of really not much of an interest to me. It is a long prose work that has invented parts, and this book has plenty of that.
Well, on that note, let me just remind you that the Corner Bookstore are out in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery. They have copies of all three books for sale, and the authors are here. We'll be happy to sign copies of books. Thank you all for coming, and once again, I want to thank the jury for all their fabulous work in the last year, and school is out. You now have the summer off, so read whatever you want. Thank you all for coming.